Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your host, Eric Mike Serino. Sadly, today, Juliet is out and cannot join us. Before we begin, we'd like to remind you that if you want to follow the latest news, research, and analysis, and also join discussions on the latest happenings throughout the Belt and Road, you can follow us on our Twitter and Facebook feeds at Belt and Road Pod. In April, a new major report was published by Alan Bassis and Claude Williams, two climatologists for the consultancy Eyes on Earth, that was entitled Monitoring the Quantity of Water Flowing Through the Upper Mekong Basin Under Natural Unimpeded Conditions. The study used satellite imagery to look at water level averages to determine the differences between measured and predicted water levels on the Mekong to study the effect mainstream dams have had on the river over time. A corresponding report from Brian Eiler and Courtney Weatherby on the Stimson Center's website entitled How China Turned Off the Tap of the Mekong River uses Eyes on Earth's research, and as the title foreshadows, shows that the data from the research shows China deliberately held back its water in the Mekong, even when millions in downstream countries were affected by severe drought in 2019. As expected, the research from Eyes on Earth and Brian's and Courtney's writing has gained a lot of well-earned international reporting on the subject. And it's with that today to say that we are very excited to have both Alan and Brian on the show today to talk about the research and the additional reporting that's came from the research. So, Alan and Brian, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here once again.
Yes, yes. And welcome back, Brian. You're the first repeat guest in Belt and Road Podcast
history. Oh, no. A repeat offender. Oh,
well, we're going to start off with that. For listeners who haven't listened to the earlier episode or read your great book, The Last Days of the Mighty Mekong, can you just give a brief overview of the modern historical developments on the Mekong region, specifically as it pertains to regional river management cooperation and the development of hydroelectric dams on the Mekong?
In 1 minute or less?
Yes, yes. Just so 1 minute or less. You got a couple decades history. You got it.
Got it. Okay, I'll jump right into it. It really is a daunting task because the history of Mekong River development is one that's very storied and filled with facts and politics and the building of dams one at a time, mostly starting from the upstream in China, and then gradually the downstream countries have altered the flow and what flows through the river through their own building of dams. And I think we should start with the Mekong itself, that the Mekong Basin is one that provides 20% of the world's freshwater fish catch to tens of millions of people that rely on that form of food and the catch of fish. And there are floodplains in Cambodia and Vietnam's Mekong Delta that are responsible for underpinning the agricultural production that supports those countries, as well as the economic stability of those countries. And when the Mekong's system, the hydrological system, is altered, then the productivity of those fisheries and those agricultural zones are impacted. And that means that what happens far upstream can impact outcomes far downstream. And Vietnam, being the most downstream country, has long been vehemently opposed to upstream damming, knowing full well, with plenty of studies in hand to prove it, that these dams change outcomes far downstream. And Vietnam has really elevated its concerns over damming on the Mekong to the level of security concerns, almost as high, or as high, some will say, in Vietnam, as high as Vietnam's concerned about China's actions in the Mekong as much as they are about China's actions in the South China Sea dispute. So damming in the Mekong began in the late 80s with the construction of one dam in China. Half of the length of the Mekong is in China. A smaller, much smaller portion of the basin is in China. The basin gets wide and it fans out as the river goes down into mainland Southeast Asia, into Laos and Myanmar and Thailand and nearly all of Cambodia. And then the Mekong Delta, which is a patch of land roughly the size of West Virginia or Denmark. From the late 1980s, when that dam was then completed in China, then the early 90s, the game changed for both building more hydropower projects on the river in China, as well as downstream. So Yunnan province in China became targeted as a hydropower-rich zone of development that could meet Chinese electricity demands well into the future. And since then, there's been built something like 23 gigawatts of electricity on the river and 11 dams. Some of the largest dams in the world have been built there, like the Xiaowan Dam, which has a wall of about 300 meters or 1,000 feet. It's the third highest dam in the world, produces 4,200 megawatts of electricity when it's running at full clip. And then the Nuojiaodu Dam is one of the largest reservoirs in the world, holding roughly half the storage capacity of the Chesapeake Bay, which is a huge body of water in the United States. And those dams were built gradually from the early 90s to the present. The last one went online in December 2018, very close to the Tibet border, to Yunnan's border with Tibet. And that has progressed without the consultation of downstream countries in any way, shape, or form, which really goes against most conventions of international water, transboundary river management platforms and mechanisms. And then downstream, actually the damming of the river in China has created conditions where the river can be regulated, the mainstream can be regulated, so much so that it loses its wildness, it's harnessed, and more dams can be built downstream because China's dams offer the opportunity to provide less water during the wet season and more water during the dry season, kind of smoothing out that natural ebb and flow, the major rise and the major fall of the Mekong each year. That actually, it's that pulse, it's that up and down that creates the Mekong's mightiness. So a boon for downstream hydropower, but a real challenge and a threat to the mightiness of the natural ecological processes of the Mekong Basin. And to date, two mainstream Mekong dams are completed. There are nine others in the pipeline or planned, but on tributaries there are already over 100 dams, more than 60 in Laos, 9 in Thailand, 16 in Vietnam. Vietnam's also an upstream country, and 2 in Cambodia. There is a intergovernmental body called the Mekong River Commission, which is made up of the membership of 4 downstream countries, Laos, Thailand, Vietnam, and Cambodia, that is tasked to oversee the sustainable management of the river. And as we talk today, I think the role and the function of the Mekong River Commission can be folded into our discussion.
Yeah, we'll certainly get into that later in our show. Now to Alan, you stated in your study that the research was meant to develop a reliable and simple model that predicts the natural flow in the Upper Mekong, that's then used as prediction to determine how the cascade of dams have altered the natural flow of the river. What was your initial catalyst for developing this model and writing this report?
One of the things that's most important to us is promoting transparency of water resources around the world. So when we reached out to the Mekong River Commission and other organizations interested in trying to get an independent quantitative measure of how much water is in the basin, we explained to them that we had developed that capacity and would like to explore the value of our wetness index to capture the natural flow of the river. One of the advantages of the wetness index is it sees water from all different sources, which has a huge advantage on the Mekong River Basin in particular, because much of the water in the upper basin originates as snow, or it's glacial melt that has been water that's been accumulating for over hundreds, sometimes even thousands of years. And it's in a crystalline state, so therefore it's not liquid. And our wetness index doesn't see it in a crystalline state, only as it's melting. Also, it sees precipitation that falls during the warm season, the wet season, and how that precipitation can begin to melt the snow packs and basically introduce the natural pulse of the river, which begins in basically May. And then when the wet season gets going, the monsoon starts going in its greatest capacity in the late summer and early fall, then it can capture all that water that's actually coming out of the basin. So the goal was then to see how well that index could capture flow that would naturally be occurring. And so the Mekong River Commission gave us a data set that is a gauge at the Chiansan location, Golden Triangle, right at the intersection of Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar. And that is an independent measure of how much water would be coming from the upper basin, since that's kind of the boundary between the upper basin, which is largely, in fact, to a very great extent, water coming out of China. And then seeing, once we could capture the natural rhythm of the river with the wetness index, how that natural rhythm of the river has been perturbed or altered as those dams were built upstream with the capacity of holding huge quantities of water back away from the natural rhythm of the river.
Really interesting. And so can you go a little bit into more of the methodology within the study? And you spoke of the wetness index, but for somebody who's not a climatologist, who doesn't understand satellite imagery, how does one use a satellite to see the wetness of an area? And why is that important for this study?
That's a very good question. I've been working in the field of climatology for quite some time, and most people work with satellite sensors in the infrared and visible. However, both of those frequencies are blocked by clouds, and therefore seeing the surface under all sky conditions is impossible. A microwave has a huge advantage that it can penetrate through clouds, much like your cell phone can penetrate through walls. And so we can see with microwave the surface basically under all sky conditions, which is huge. However, microwave is highly sensitive to water. So we had an issue that was basically interfering with our ability to monitor the surface, and that is the bias of water at the surface was giving us a cold signature. And we could see that, I mean, being a geographer and knowing the spatial patterns across the globe, when I was looking at the temperature patterns as derived by the microwave, it was showing me all the places where liquid water is accumulating near the surface. So I was seeing lakes and rivers and bogs and melting snow and recent precipitation. And I went back to the theory behind using microwaves for monitoring the surface. And indeed, it demonstrates that there would be a cold bias with water. In fact, a very distinct cold bias. So we spent years developing a capacity to monitor how much water is at the surface using the microwaves. There's a number of frequencies in the microwave spectrum that we have on the satellite instrument. It's called the Special Sensor Microwave Imager. And it's been flown since basically 1987 and still flown operationally. And so we were able to look at that satellite and we were able to calibrate the bias associated with liquid water at the surface by using in situ data as calibration points. We worked at the largest climate archive in the world, and therefore we had all sorts of reliable calibration data from surface measurements. So we were able to combine both the best of satellite and surface measurements to do a value-added product. And the value-added product ended up being the percentage of the surface that's water. Our goal was actually to try to back out that noise so we could derive temperature, but it became apparent by working with the USDA that the wetness index was actually as valuable, and maybe even more valuable, than monitoring surface temperature because it's unique. And we have almost 30 years of data now, so we can monitor the variability of soil moisture and surface wetness in near real time all around the globe. So as a result of that, I was asked to use this index to see how well it could correspond with river flow along the Mekong Basin, the upper basin in particular.
Really interesting. So with all of this in mind, with the ability to do this within the wetness index, what were your main findings in your research?
What we found is that the sensors on the satellite that are the basis of the wetness index was able to accurately capture the natural rhythm of the river. Once we got the data from the Mekong River Commission, our first goal was to set out and identify the boundary of the upper Mekong Basin. So what we did is we got a map called a shapefile that defines the boundary of the basin itself. Then we used that boundary to identify the satellite observations inside the basin itself. And we extracted all the rest of the world that was outside the basin, since we only want to see how much water in the upper basin is contributing to natural flow as measured by the Tiansan gauge. We traditionally look for a period of time that's most representative of natural flow. And so a lot of data mining at that point is imperative. So and also doing research. So it, as Brian already alluded, that the early part of the period of record that the satellite is able to measure the wetness was being impacted by the building of one of the first dams on the river. It was the Manwan Dam. And although a relatively small dam compared to the ones built later in the period of record, it still had a substantial impact on the natural flow. So we chose to stay away from that period. We've been doing a lot of modeling and calibration work for decades, and we've learned one thing time and time again, and that is we need adequate data to represent the characteristic that we're looking for. And we need strong signal of noise so that we can capture those relationships. And we need to make sure that we remove any data out of the calibration period that is containing features that are not representative of what we're looking to identify. And since we did not want to identify how the construction of the Manwan Dam was affecting natural flow, we stayed away from that period, both when they were constructing it and right afterwards when they were actually demonstrating the capacity and releasing excess water out of the reservoir to produce their hydroelectric potential. So we looked for a period when things had stabilized. But we had to stay away from 2002 because yet another dam was being constructed and commissioned at that time. So we had a window. And we've been doing enough statistics that we knew that we needed to find a representation of natural flow during that window of the first dam and the second dam. Fortunately, as Brian has already stated, that the natural pulse of the river creates a huge annual cycle. During the winter time, most of the precipitation that falls, and it's a relatively dry time of the year as well, falls as snow, and it's not melting, and it's not flowing into the river. And so there's very low flow during the months of November and decreasing as you go through the dry season until it warms up enough that that snowpack can begin to melt, which is around May. These are really high altitudes. I mean, 10, 15,000, I think even 20,000 feet in some locations. So there's glaciers up there as well that are melting during the warm season of the year when the sun is high in the sky and basically causing the terminals of the glaciers to start melting into the river basin. So we picked that period knowing that there was a huge annual cycle. Every year, there was a natural pulse of the river. It was drying out during the dry season, and then a huge pulse of water would be admitted downstream during the wet season. I don't know how much meteorology you want me to go into, but during I hadn't even spoken about this with Brian, but during the wet season, over the Tibetan Plateau, a thermal low develops in the high altitudes, which creates basically a natural instability, drawing warm, moist air from the tropics up into the basin and then causing a fair amount of precipitation and much higher rainfall rates than during the dry season. So you have basically three things happening during the wet season. You're having a lot more precipitation, you're having melting of the snowpack, and you're having glacial melt because in the Tibetan Plateau, the glaciers are melting at a higher rate than most anywhere else in the world. So a lot of that water that's been accumulating for hundreds, even thousands of years, that bank account is being depleted. And the Chinese know that. That may be one reason why they're building capacity to hold that water while it's still available to be held. And so we built a model around that calibration period of 1997 to 2001. Now, some people are saying that's too short of a period. We can substantiate that there's a tremendous amount of signal of noise between every year having that annual cycle of wet and dry, and that it is the best representation of natural flow in the period of time when we have satellite record. So it makes much more sense to calibrate it during a limited time of excellent data than expanding the calibration period to contain areas and periods of time when the natural flow of the river is not actually maintained. So this is why we picked a limited period to do the model calibration. And we came up with an R squared of 0.89, which means 89% of the variability of natural flow as measured by the Tianshan gauge can be directly measured by the wetness index. That is a quite very respectable R squared. We have a highly significant model at the 0.9999 confidence level. and only two variables with 59 degrees of freedom. And the two variables are the linear relationship to the gauge measurements as well as the quadratic relationship of the wetness index, because water does not flow in a linear structure. It has a quadratic structure to it. I can explain that very easily in that I use an analogy of a sponge. If you have a dry sponge and you put water on it, water's not going to really flow out of the sponge. It's going to start being absorbed, much like soil. However, as you start increasing the amount of water in the sponge, water is going to start flowing out. So it's a nonlinear relationship. A little bit of water doesn't release flow. More water releases substantial more flow. Once the sponge is saturated, or the soil is saturated, then it can contain no more water and all the water is released. So it's not linear. And the Mekong River Commission identified that, and we completely agree with it. So we have a quadratic component of the model as well.
So that's really fascinating how you're able to develop through this five-year time span the natural flow in the river. Within your research, how much did it change, especially last year in 2019, in terms of the predicted flow and the actual flow?
Originally, our study was not to monitor this extreme drought. It was a preliminary pilot study to demonstrate or to explore the utility of the wetness index to capture the natural flow. So it was a relatively small study that was commissioned before the 2019 wet season. In fact, we only had data originally through March of 2019. And so what we saw once we calibrated the model on the period of natural flow is we started seeing the impact of the dams very directly, both in filling the reservoirs before the dams were commissioned, basically excessively high flow after the dams were commissioned because they're releasing water out of the reservoirs and producing the full potential of high capacity of their hydroelectric potential. And then after they release water from the reservoirs, they have to actually refill them. And we were seeing the impacts of these artificial manipulations of flow through the construction and the management of the dams during the first two dams. And then later in particular, the two larger dams, the Xiaowan Dam and then the Nozhandu Dam. The Xiaowan Dam was 2009. That was very apparent. But the most blatant alteration of flow was in 2012, after the largest reservoir on the river was established and the capacity to alter the natural flow was most pronounced after the construction of this dam and its capacity to restrict flow. And so we saw, after 2012, we saw very unnatural rhythms of the river. And you could see early on the natural pulse of the river very well. After 2012, those natural pulse of the rivers were completely perturbed and in extremely unnatural ways, understanding hydrology and the way in which rivers naturally flow in pulses that have waves to them, not in these start stops. These start and stops of quick releases and then quick containment of water can only be regulated by dams. That's not natural to a river. But you see it in the data downstream at the Xiaowan gauge, and you see how that compares to what the natural flow of the river would be. I presented these results in Hanoi at a symposium where the Mekong River Commission was involved. One of the representatives from the Mekong River Commission said, "That's really exciting how accurate you're able to capture the natural pulse of the river. We had a huge drought in 2019. If we update the data through the 2019 wet season, can you update from the gauge? Can you update the data from your wetness index and see how they align during this unique year?" So we did that, and we found something that had never been seen before over the period of record in the study, and that is the natural pulse of the river ceased to exist in 2019.
Wow.
So then the whole natural pulse of the river, instead of going up during the wet season, actually went down. And so the argument was, well, how that the whole rhythm of the river, the whole climatology of the river, the whole history of the river has a natural pulse. So why is it missing? And this is where the discussions have been. So where, you know, what caused the missing water? And so this is where we stand in the discussion today.
Brian, so given the research from Alan and Eyes on Earth, can you give a political context to this scientific finding? I mean, what does this is rather big. What does this mean for the Mekong region, right, that there was such a disparity, especially in 2019, but also in prior years?
Well, I think that we have to divide what we know and what we don't know yet. And we know that the Mekong monsoon was not observed. The Mekong pulse was not observed at the Changzhen Gauge. Eyes on Earth's wetness index shows that there was enough water to generate that pulse. And so something happened there. We're not quite sure what happened, but we know it did, if we believe in the findings of the Eyes on Earth study. And I think that the confidence levels that Alan has discussed show us that there's something to believe here. Now, how that translates into impacts downstream also needs to be further verified. I mean, for the longest time, communities in and around that gauge in Changzhen have been observing these seasonal differences. They even observe day-to-day differences, and they'll tell you that ever since the first dam went online at Manwan, the river's hydrological cycle was changed. They'll talk about it when the Xiaowan Dam went online in 2009. They observed day-to-day changes in the level of the river. And then the Nuojadu Dam, you know, further complicated and added a kind of deeper cuts to the river cycle. And we can get into those in a bit. But, there were these rock bottom, dry, bare scenes of the river bed all the way from the Golden Triangle to Vientiane, where most of, up until the findings came out, most of the causality to that was laid on El Nino factors and the incremental impacts of all the dams. And now what I think Alan's findings and Alan and Claude and Eyes on Earth's findings show is that China's dams restricted an incredible amount of water over the wet season of last year. And up to Vientiane, there's something like 50% of the river volume comes from China. So what China's dams do ultimately impacts the level that is observed at Vientiane. I think Alan and Claude and the team are working to translate their findings from river height to actual volume and changes in volume. And I think that will help further justify and explain what happened farther downstream. But the restriction of water impacts the Mekong mainstream and those areas that rely on water, take water from the Mekong mainstream. That would be the mainstream itself. The communities and the cities along the mainstream would have had restricted water availability. And certainly we saw that during the drought last year. And then the Tonle Sap, which is the world's largest inland fishery, takes on water from the Mekong mainstream during the monsoon season. There's this reversal of the river that drains the Tonle Sap in Cambodia as water from the Mekong pushes water back up into that lake. You know, the river backs up and something like 70 times the amount of water that's in there in the dry season goes in during the wet season. That reversal typically lasts for 5 months. It's probably the most ecological process that creates the mightiness of the Mekong. It's been described as the beating heart of the Mekong, this expansion and contraction year on year that produces a 2.6 million ton fish catch. That typically lasts 5 months. And this 2019, that reversal, the rhythm lasted 5 weeks. If more water were in the mainstream, it's very likely that that reversal, that period of expansion and contraction, would have lasted longer. How much longer? We don't know. This needs to be validated, and studies can be done to show how much longer that would have been. And then in the Mekong Delta, where water is taken from the mainstream for irrigation purposes and drives flood cycles that keep the delta healthy and strong, that freshwater availability just wasn't there. So the impacts are profound. The impacts on water availability to humans were profound. And very importantly, the impacts to these critical ecological cycles of the Mekong Basin, the ecological processes of the Mekong Basin were impacted. How much still needs to be studied further. But I think the political impacts are that now it's very clear that there are multiple ways to measure, there are multiple ways to monitor what's happening in China's upstream dams, how they're being operated, how much water is available there, and that these tools are readily at our disposal, whether it's from a climate consultancy, a non-government agency, a government agency, to be able to lift the veil on what China's doing. And to date, China hasn't been a good partner for data transparency in the region. As the most upstream partner, China has been very reluctant to share data on water availability, reservoir operations, as well as releases. And releases from the most downstream dam, that data has been progressively coming online, I would say in a very reluctant way. But it is, you know, slowly being disseminated to the Mekong River Commission, to the national governments. And I think this has improved China's position to a certain extent within the region as, you know, becoming more transparent. But these are baby steps compared to what should be shared to the downstream countries. And data transparency is critically important in times of when drought relief is needed. And I think last year during 2019, Eyes on Earth's findings show that the water was available at a time when water was greatly needed. So these transparent methods can help inform decision makers on their own actions for pushing for more cooperation or emergency water releases.
And so with that, in 2019, the showings from Eyes on Earth says that in the reservoir, there was enough water there. And at the same time, there's a drought affecting millions of people downstream on the Mekong. Your article on the Stimson Center's website, you know, how China turned off the tap of the Mekong River, would seem that that would be a deliberate action. What would be the internal logic for China to hold back this water?
And that's a great question, Eric, and we still do not know. And I think it's really unfair to point to nefarious means or some type of plan from the upstream overlord to choke the country's downstream. And, you know, to date, as a person who speaks to the media, who speaks to researchers, speaks to policymakers frequently, on things happening in the entirety of the Mekong Basin, that was the first time that I used the word China has turned off the tap. And I've always been very careful about that because, you know, these are reservoirs that are not static things. They have to let water through. Water is spinning turbines. Water is being let through the floodgates. You know, ultimately, hydrological cycle is altered, and this is something that numerous studies have shown, and I think the Eyes on Earth study has corroborated that. But turning off the tap is a very different thing. And again, I think in 2019, we saw that happened. Now, why that happened, we really don't know. And we're looking at, Alan and I and Claude, his partner and others, are looking at some newer evidence. You know, this has started a really interesting technical and public policy discourse where others are jumping in and showing us their findings and saying, you know, there's a moment here where we can drive these processes forward. And we're beginning to look at some new information from satellite data that helps put together a picture that could lead to why. But without that, you know, we can only speculate. We know what happened. We can only speculate. And either that water is being stored for future hydropower use, or that water is just being stored for storage sake, which is interesting because last week, China's embassy in Bangkok began to describe the upstream projects, not as hydropower projects, but as irrigation projects, which I found to be fascinating. It's the first time they've ever not been described as hydropower projects. So that shows a little bit of, you know, China's descriptive intent of use of those dams. And there's always the possibility that water has been taken out of the system and transferred someplace for agricultural purposes to relieve drought in Yunnan, or for an interbasin transfer to take it from like the Mekong into another basin that leads down into China proper. And while I haven't seen, you know, that type of project would be a well-funded, well-reported on project. I've lived in Yunnan and watched those projects be reported on. There's never been one reported on for the Mekong interbasin transfer. But it's not out of the realm of possibility. And I think as we continue to look in this, we'll be able to deduce which motivations are possible, which aren't possible. And finally, you know, getting back to the whole imagining China as a monolith, that there are, you know, operators in Beijing that are dictating the future of how the Mekong impacts the downstream countries. You know, I think that it's important just to come back to the basics on China, that there's a division between localities and Beijing. There's a lack of communication. There's a lack of coordination. There is a lack of coordination between each of these dams. Even though they're owned by the same company, I think they can be coordinated and operated in concert at times. But we shouldn't just assume that there's some coordinated, concerted effort here, that perhaps lack of communication, incompetence has led to what we observed in the Eyes on Earth findings. And it, to this point, you know, all motivations and possibilities should be looked at. But what we can't deny is what happened. And the Eyes on Earth findings shows very clearly that so much water was restricted that it broke the Mekong monsoon cycle at the Changsan gauge.
China's foreign ministry has responded to the report by saying that the research is groundless and that the drought was due to reduced precipitation, abnormal monsoon that was combined with an extreme El Nino events, and that this drought also affected China. Furthermore, China has also been said that they've been cooperating now with the Mekong River Commission to study the causes of the droughts. Alan, is there merit to these natural causes China has cited?
Well, there is natural variability, and certainly there's years of wetter and drier periods. That's one of the reasons why we wanted to look at the capacity of the wetness index to capture the natural pulse of the river and to also capture the interannual variability. Does it capture some years when the pulse is smaller and some years when it's higher? The results demonstrated that this was an average, possibly even slightly above average wet season. And so the water would have been there to promote the flow coming to the Tiansan gauge. Then some of the statements that they made us go back and do some research. There clearly was not a major El Nino. In fact, one could, by studying the data, show that any remnant of an El Nino had ceased to have any signal after July of 2019. It was what we call El Nino or ENSO neutral. And even the months of May and June were fairly weak as far as an El Nino signal. So you can't use that, put your finger on that and use it as a indication. As far as drought goes, there was plenty of wetness upstream to promote the natural rhythm of the river. There was a relatively dry period in May and a little drier in June. And after July, the wetness was average or above average for the remainder of the wet season through October. So you can't put your finger on that one and use it as a substantiation for the lack of water. So it's hard to see any reasons why the rhythm of the river should not have occurred as it has occurred in all the previous years, both from understanding climatology and also looking at the independent data sources. One thing that I would like to add, I think it's very important, is that we're only measuring water in the upper basin. And we demonstrated with supplemental information that the wetness index can be used not only to monitor river flow, but also agricultural drought. And there was a huge agricultural drought that obviously had an impact on river flow coming out of Thailand. It was a fairly unprecedented drought as far as its severity, and it lasted for a solid two and a half months. So that had a huge impact on the amount of water that would have naturally entered the lower basin and therefore the flow into Cambodia and Tonle Sap and the Delta. So we're not saying that the reduction in flow coming from the upper basin was the primary cause of the severe drought downstream. What we're saying is that the natural pulse of the river that would have promoted water resources downstream was basically not available, but was restricted upstream by the reservoirs.
Interesting.
Now, Eric, if I can add to that, one thing we often hear out of China, and it came out in these official pronouncements, is that, well, you know, our portion of the river only contributes like 13% of the total flow to the basin. First, I just want to say you start cutting 13% in half or even in quarters, and then you start feeling the effects, you know. And, you know, just think of like reducing your own salary by 4% or 5%. You start to feel that. But these average flow inputs for an annual average of something like 13% is really a useless figure in a system where the hydrology shifts from one of an extreme wet high pulse to one of an extreme low. And then the variability really begins to show if we look at the difference between the dry and the wet season. So in the dry season, China can contribute something like 40% or more, and this has been demonstrated in several peer-reviewed studies, to the total flow of the Mekong system. And that's significant. And then in the monsoon season, it's something like 9%. So because those tributaries downstream are very wet, and there's a lot of rain happening, they're contributing much more. Now, the period in question is this wet season of 2019, when the downstream was extremely dry, and China's portion was not dry. So it's looking to mirror something like a dry season pattern where we know China's contribution is 40% or more. So during that time, the effects are likely coming from an impact on 40% or more of the river's water flow.
Really interesting. Since the research has come out, and also some of your writing, Brian, independent reviews have been published that look at the methods and the conclusions of the publication. And just wanted to ask a few questions that came about from some of them. One response that was written by Marco Calio and Amy Fallon states that a key limitation of the Eyes on Earth report is that the author's analysis was based on water level rather than water volume, giving only a partial picture of the situation in the Lansang River. Alan, can you first explain the difference in using water level rather than water volume, other than the somewhat obvious, how that would or could affect in the research, and address the usage of water level in the report rather than water volume?
If you look at river gauges, if you've been by a location where the river is being measured, it's being measured by height. I mean, that's the way that we have traditionally measured basically all rivers. And then you take that height measurement, you know the profile of the basin where the water's flowing, and then you do some calculus, integration actually, basically volume. Mm-hmm. So it starts with river height, and then you need to know the shape of the boundary. When I was given the data, the first question I had was, do you have volume? And the answer was, well, we don't know the shape of the boundary throughout the period of record from 1992 to current because it's constantly changing, because you know, riverbanks are dynamic. There's sandbars that develop in a river, and obviously where there's sand, the river's not flowing. So that needs to be taken into the shape of the boundary if the gauge is being impacted by a sandbar at its location. So all these things basically make it a one-step process. You start with river height, and then you know the shape of the boundary, and you go to volume. We want to go to volume. Everyone basically is familiar in talking about volume. So we're going back and talking with various people who do have some of the profiles of the river basin, and we're making sure that the river height are properly transferred to volume. That's done regularly. It's just that this was originally not supposed to be such a study that was going to be under such recognition. And so when I was told that all they had was height, I said, well, let's start with that. Obviously, we need to go past it, and we will.
And at second, in that same independent review, they had their own complex model. I can't begin to describe here, but the conclusion from it was that their analysis suggested that it is improbable that China's dam cascade could store an entire wet season's worth of rainfall, subsequently be the primary cause of the 2019 drought. And so if their model shows that China's dam cascade could not store an entire season's worth of rainfall, and the water did not materialize in lower Mekong, you might have addressed this a little bit in the earlier, but where could have the water gone?
Great question. And I mean, I've learned so much through this process. I'm a policy person and an environmentalist, and not someone who has deep training in hydrology and hydrologic modeling. So
you and me both.
So it's it's a real pleasure to work with Alan and others who do have the data, who do have the tools at hand to, again, provide insight, to stir the public discourse, to dig deeper into what happened in 2019. And the Aalto University team's conclusion of not having enough water comes from their interpretation of how much active storage can be held in those reservoirs. So the idea is that, so much water is coming into those reservoirs that if a level is exceeded cumulatively above those reservoirs, then they're going to top over, right? They're going to have an overspill. So physically, what they're saying is that the amount of water that the wetness index observed would have had to have left the system, or the wetness index has a problem, needs further verification for this to be true. And I think it's interesting because, one, then we can look into this idea of active storage. Getting the technical details, there are basically two layers of water in a reservoir. You've got the active storage, that's what is used to produce hydropower and can be called upon to turn the turbines. And then there's what's called dead storage, which is never really leaving the reservoir. It's there to produce the head, the hydrologic pressure to turn those turbines and to create height in that reservoir. And it's possible that the dead storage far down below in the reservoir was drained prior to this monsoon season, so much so that the amount of water could be held. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that dead storage was drained to release sediment, to have sediment flushing down through the system, because dams need to clean out their backyards, if you will, because if the reservoirs get filled up with too much sediment, then the dams themselves become less effective and less efficient. So the only way to know about that is to really take a deep look at what the reservoirs were doing. We're beginning to look at satellite data that can compare what happened in 2019 to a 10-year baseline on what like normal reservoir operations look like versus the abnormality of 2019. But I just want to also throw out a possibility. And previously, I really didn't think it was possible that both findings are true, that Eyes on Earth wetness index showed above normal amounts of water, that water was collected in those reservoirs and restricted, and that but those reservoirs could not hold an entire monsoon season's worth of water. And if both are true, then that means some water left the system previous to being observed at the Changsend Gate. And that's something that also can be, the story can begin to be told through some of this kind of detective work on looking at satellite readings on the reservoir operations. That could manifest in the form of charging the ground in agricultural areas that are impacted by drought, or by transferring the water through a canal system or some other transfer system to another basin. And the good news is like the wetness index can look for that. The satellite data readings can show this. And, you know, as we dig deeper, we'll be able to put together a fuller picture of what happened. Ultimately, to make things easier for everyone, it's really in China's hands to share its data, to fully disclose what happened last year. It would save everyone a lot of time. And but until that happens, you know, these tools to promote transparency will continue to be used to put together a fuller picture of what happened.
For the review of the Eyes on Earth research and also the Stimson feature came out from the Australia Mekong partnership, and it posed some additional questions. And first, I just wanted to Alan, one limitation that was cited from the partnership was the research's lack of comparative analysis of somewhat similar research that's happened in the past, and also a formalized peer review process. Can you address this?
Yes, I'm happy to do so. We've had a conversation with the AMPERES group and acknowledged that the details of the wetness index and the history of it towards the application of monitoring river basins was not as well explained in the paper as could have been. This research was actually peer-reviewed with the World Bank in 2010 and then published around 2012, in which the same gauge and the same basin was analyzed using the wetness index to anchor the relationship between natural flow and gauge measurements and then see if we could use that to monitor the natural flow into the future. The input data for that was less than stellar and the results were less than stellar as a consequence, because again, the importance of good data is essential for understanding and building a scientific inquiry and then to have findings that identify whether you've got skill and what signal it provides. So we walked them through that. I think one of these questions that we spent quite a bit of time discussing during our conversation, one was the understanding of how the wetness index impacts flow. In other words, how do you use water near the surface to identify water entering the river basin itself and flowing through the river? And that water originates from multiple sources. Some of it is coming from the ground. Some of it's being run across the surface. Some of it is percolating kind of through the ground and also, and then coming out as springs into the small tributaries. It's a combination of all these features. It's also evapotranspiration rate, how much water is actually leaving the surface. What are the melt rates in the snowpack and how much of that is flowing into the ground and how much is flowing across the surface? How quickly are the snowpacks melting? How much of the glaciers are melting? And particularly since that is a source of water that you're not receiving as precipitation, it's what we call fossil water. It's once it's gone, and they're melting quickly. So all these things have to be integrated together, and it's very and physical models are very complex, not only in the number of parameters that they monitor, but how they interact with those parameters in the model. One of the advantages of the wetness index is that it already integrates many of these factors into its one value. It happened by accident. Remember, we were not after creating a wetness index. But we do see its value. And we also understand that it's just one of many tools. And people that have been working on the basin have the understanding, the tools, the experience. And we're newcomers to the basin and to the hydrology and to the politics and the issues and the policies. And we're standing strictly with the science. But it also gives us an opportunity to work with the scientists who have had long experience with the basin to start collaborating with them and understanding how we basically have a synergy and that we can collaborate together and start answering some of these additional questions that Brian is raising. And the answers are always intriguing. And following the water is much like following the money. You can't hide it. So I think with our new technologies and our desire and capacity to work together, we can start reaching some of these answers that I think are in front of everyone right now.
Yeah, most definitely. And to Brian, the review from the Australia Mekong Partnership also stressed that, you know, the model and the research was a positive step for further understanding and created good evidence for further study. But that some of the conclusions from the Stimson Center's piece were maybe too definite to come from this one study. What would be your response to this?
Well, to be clear, you know, no one is making any type of causal connection between China's upstream dams, how they're operated, and the amount of rainfall that falls in the lower basin. You know, that's absurd. And so if our articles or Eyes on Earth's findings are interpreted as, you know, being the main driver of drought throughout the entirety of the Mekong watershed, including all the tributary areas, you know, that's an entirely wrong interpretation of what we've been saying to date. We are saying very clearly that the restrictions of water in 2019 from those upstream dams impacted water availability at Changseng Gauge, and that translated downstream to other parts of the Mekong mainstream and the areas that take water from the mainstream, like the Tonle Sap, like Northeast Thailand, like the Mekong Delta. Those particular impacts need to be studied. However, you know, my op-ed in the Foreign Policy read something like, science has convinced me that China's dams are devastating the Mekong. And I stick to that. This has long been documented that the operations of those dams are so powerful that they can raise the level of the river during the dry season and restrict what was previously unknown, the amounts of water during the wet season. And now Eyes on Earth's studies show when, for how long, and to what extent those restrictions and releases happen. And that type of river regulation is devastating for the Mekong because it undoes these ecological processes that make the Mekong mighty. It reduces the expansion and contraction period of the Tonle Sap. These dams as well, they hold back something like 50% of the sediment of all the Mekong system. And that's critically important for agricultural production, for fisheries in the Tonle Sap and in the Mekong Delta. And when we think about the Mekong Delta, that sediment restriction itself reduces the ability for the Mekong Delta to become viable, to be geologically viable. So with less sediment distributed across that landscape, it's more and more likely to fall into the ocean or to be inundated by rising seas in a faster period of time. These things are devastating. These things undo economic processes that underpin the stability of the region. And the processes are being undone at a very rapid rate. Now, this is not to say that it's only China's dams that are delivering these challenges, the devastation to the Mekong. There are many other factors that countries are doing on the ground by building their own dams or their own land use policies. But more so than ever before, the Eisenhower studies really has shined a light on the impacts of China's upstream dams and has convinced me that those impacts are devastating.
Well, wonderful. Well, Alan and Brian, this has been such a pleasure to be able to speak with both of you and to be able to ask these questions, get more clarification on this wonderful research that Eyes on Earth did and subsequent writing that Brian, you and your colleagues at the Stimson Center have been able to publish. Will you stick around for recommendations?
Sure. Looking forward to it.
Be happy to.
You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Remember, if you'd like to follow the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod. Brian, do you have a recommendation for our listeners today?
Sure. Well, it's interesting that this question is being asked now because I received an advanced galley copy of Sebastian Strangio's In the Dragon's Shadow, Southeast Asia in the Chinese Century, a title not without controversy. That book will be released at the end of September of this year, and Sebastian is a friend and colleague of mine. Sent it to me to see if I'm interested in writing a review, which I am interested in doing. And it goes through country by country examination of China's impact in the 10 countries of Southeast Asia. And there's a great section on the Mekong in there. He does an excellent job at tying up all the central arguments. And as I was reading through it last night, I came across a paragraph on Alan and Claude's study, which has just come out in the last month, less than a month ago, and Sebastian was able to get it into the final publication. So it's great to see that these findings are now being taken up into kind of the mainstream literature on what's happening in Southeast Asia.
Amazing. Yeah, that sounds, I can't wait to be able to read that in September. Alan, do you have a recommendation for our listeners today?
It appears that this is starting to unravel a bit like a detective story. And the mystery is the water. Never in my wildest dreams would I've thought such a simple study would have gotten such intrigue and recognition with so many multitude of players. And with our capacity with satellites, countries and organizations can no longer hide what they're doing. With the complement of the various technicians, scientists, politicians, policymakers, NGOs, and more importantly, people who are impacted by it directly in their day-to-day life, because really that's what it's about, we'll start to see the pieces of information reveal the truth. And I think the truth in many ways in life is far more interesting than the simple stories that we try to tell ourselves. So I think if people stay tuned to this story, we're going to start getting answers that take us in unexpected directions. And hopefully this will start to reveal how we can monitor water, not just on the Mekong Basin, but throughout the world.
Lovely. And finally, I have two recommendations for today. First is Capital and Ideology by Thomas Piketty. I skipped his first book, The Capital, but decided to start right with his sequel, maybe only a sixth through it right now, and it's certainly a tome of a book with wide-ranging ambition and maybe too much detail at points. But the basic structure thus far, looking at history through the lens of inequality regimes, has been illuminating thus far. So have it on audiobook. It's been fun. And secondly, just TikTok. Like many of my millennial brothers and sisters, TikTok is that app that seems to be the first piece of technology that's not made for us. It's made for the younger generation. I'm still slightly confused by the whole thing, and I don't post anything, but the amount of human creativity and humor and life hack videos are really addicting, and it's my only social media feed that's not thoroughly depressing with constant awful news that's happening around the world. So it's been fun for me thus far. So downloading TikTok.
You're making me feel older, Eric.
Yeah, well, I go on the app and I feel old in it. I'm just like, I don't know what's going on here. But anyway, Alan, Brian, thanks again so much for joining us in the Belt and Road podcast.
Always happy to help. Take care.